series is offered monthly and covers a variety of topics related to the ABA. Today's session is titled Accommodating Persons with Environmental Sensitivities, and we're privileged to be joined by our presenters, Mary Lemiel and Daryl Jones, and I'll introduce them both shortly. Again, individuals joining us today are using a variety of mediums, including the telephone, mobile devices, and via our webinar platform. A written transcript of this session will be created, edited, and posted to the www.aba-audio.org website, along with a digital recording of the session within about 10 business days following the conclusion of our program. Our presenters will provide us with some valuable information today, and at the conclusion of the presentation, there will be an opportunity for everyone to ask questions. Again, those on the telephone will be able to submit questions to the presenter via instructions provided by the operator. Individuals participating via the webinar platform may submit your questions via the chat area. All questions will be conveyed to the presenters. Depending on the number of questions, we may not be able to address all of them today, but we encourage you to follow up with your questions to your regional ADA center, and you can do that by calling 1-800-949-4232. So again, I'm going to begin today's session by introducing our presenters. Mary Lemiel is the founder and executive director of the National Center for Environmental Health Strategies in Voorhees, New Jersey. Daryl Jones is the project director for the IONET and New Community.
Apologize for the technical difficulties. These are, however, outside of our control. Marissa, if you can go ahead and do a sound check.
Sure. How is that? Does everyone hear us now? Can you hear me now?
Mary, can you go ahead and do a sound check?
Mary Lemiel, hello.
All right. We are all set to go ahead. Go ahead and continue. Mary, thank you for your patience, everyone.
So I'm on page 2, and I'm going to give a brief overview of the presentation. I'll highlight the unique health, medical, and disability access needs faced by people with chemical and electrical sensitivities or intolerances, discuss the importance of healthy indoor environmental quality, or IEQ, provide a brief history of federal recognition of chemical sensitivities, and review select policies, programs, and practices, and talk about eliminating or reducing environmental access barriers, accommodating people with chemical and electrical sensitivities, and examples of harassment and discrimination. Next. When we talk about people disabled with chemical sensitivities, we're talking about a two-stage illness, initiation and triggering. Initiation can either be by an acute exposure to pesticides, a toxic spill, moving into a new home or office, or chronic low-level exposures from being in a sick building, toxic cleaning products, for example. The affected individual will over time start reacting to more and more different substances and products at lower and lower exposure levels. Reactions are triggered by low-level everyday chemical and environmental exposures such as pesticides, so weed killers, bug sprays, treated wood products, solvents. Then we're dealing with paints, glues, gasoline, nail polish, indoor air volatile organic compounds, so new carpet, formaldehyde, plasticizers, cleaning agents, bleach, ammonia, phenol disinfectants such as Lysol and air fresheners, combustion-related products, drugs, medical devices such as over-the-counter and prescription medications, anesthetics, implants, vaccines, and chemotherapy. Many individuals also react to foods, food additives, and preservatives to natural substances and electromagnetic fields. And in all these areas, individual tolerances will vary from person to person. When we're talking about who is affected by chemical sensitivities or chemical intolerances, we're talking about a range of people. About a third of the U.S. population is affected by everyday exposures, tobacco smoke, pesticides, perfumes, of which around 16% are unusually sensitive, and up to 6% chronically ill or disabled. Studies done in California, New Mexico, behavioral risk factor surveillance surveys, which is CDC funding into a state on public health issues, asked a question of, do you consider yourself allergic or unusually sensitive to everyday chemicals like those in household cleaning supplies, paints, perfumes, soaps, garden sprays, or things like that? The California study done in 1995 by scientists Kreutzer and Neutra, published in the American Journal of Epidemiology, found that 60% of the Californians surveyed were allergic or unusually sensitive to everyday chemicals, 6.3% with a diagnosis of multiple chemical sensitivity or environmental illness, the terms used in that study, 4% unusual sensitivity to a lot of chemicals. And a personal conversation with Kreutzer, he indicated he was surprised by the numbers at the time, but they found that these were consistent across the state, across all demographics, so particularly validating. In New Mexico in 1997, their findings were that 16% were allergic or unusually sensitive to everyday chemicals, so the same, and 2% with a diagnosis of multiple chemical sensitivity or environmental illness. Next. Two national surveys done by Stan Caress and Ann Steineman in 2002 and 2005 came up with the numbers 11.1% and 11.6% respectively, reporting hypersensitivity to common chemical products, whereas a most recent study in 2012 done by Dr. Claudia Miller and her colleagues found that 20.3% of primary care patients that came into two clinics in San Antonio, Texas, met the criteria for chemical intolerance based on completion of the validated Quick Environmental Exposure Sensitivity Inventory, or the QEESI survey. Their finding was that chemical intolerance occurs in 1 in 5 primary care patients, yet is rarely diagnosed by busy practitioners. Next. Electrical or electromagnetic sensitivities or intolerances. People with electrical sensitivities react to electromagnetic fields from electrical devices and frequencies. Reactions are triggered by electrical appliances and devices, by microwaves, transformers, high-tension wires, by computers, cordless phones, cell phones and smartphones, cell towers, Wi-Fi, fluorescent lights, and smart meter and similar exposures. Again, individual tolerances may vary. A study done in 2002 in California found that 3% of the population reported sensitivities to electromagnetic fields. A most recent European study in April of this year found that 3 to 5% of the population reported electrical sensitivities. Next. This is a chart developed by Dr. Claudia Miller that I think is helpful for helping folks understand the elusive nature of identifying this condition. She uses the term toxic-induced loss of tolerance for people with chemical sensitivities or intolerances. So you have the MD being the Titanic coming along, only seeing the top of that iceberg, so only seeing, the doctor sees the symptoms, makes a diagnosis. The symptoms or the reactions that someone is experiencing can vary on a day-to-day basis, on an hourly basis, depending upon what they're exposed to. So people have kaleidoscope of overlapping symptoms, which it makes it very difficult to tease out exposure response. What the doctor does not see is the iceberg under the water. That is that we're dealing with a susceptible person who has that initiating exposure, loses their tolerance, and then is reacting to all types of things on a day-to-day basis. And the other confounding factor is masking, in that if you don't eliminate all exposures, you can't get to a baseline and then again see that exposure response involved in the condition. Next. the toxic-induced loss of tolerance, again, Dr. Claudia Miller's name for this disease process, this is a chart she has of the many conditions, so the spectrum of conditions for which intolerances to chemicals is a hallmark. I think this is very revealing for understanding chemical sensitivity or chemical intolerances, because everything from migraines to seizures, autism, asthma, autoimmune diseases, eczema, all these various conditions are conditions that someone who reports being disabled by chemical sensitivities or chemical intolerances can experience. And it's relevant in a disability framework because it's not the absence of a ramp that keeps people with these disabilities from having access, but it's the environmental barriers. Next. This is a graphic of an environmental medical unit, so the drawing of an EMU, or environmental medical unit, which would be a hospital-based facility for research, diagnosis, and treatment of these conditions. Most relevant in the instance of a chemical event, so a chemical spill, terrorist attack, where Gulf War veterans, where people experience a significant exposure and then develop illness quite rapidly, or people with complex illness patterns where the doctors are unable to tease out what's going on and to address the multiple conditions that a person might experience. Research in this fashion has been recommended by over six different government and scientific meetings and actually mandated twice by Congress but never funded. This is actually Dr. Claudia Miller's proposal, but there have been units in other countries, most recently in Japan. And when we think about why do we need EMUs, one factor is that inert environment. So you have an environment where it's metal, it's stainless steel, it's terrazzo floors, it's porcelain walls. Everything is as inert as possible. Then you want to remove the patient from all everyday exposures, from consumer products, from foods, from various environmental exposures. So you're eliminating the background noise, all those different exposures. And that would be similar to a person who might think, am I having jitteriness or headaches from caffeine, whether in coffee or soda? And that person needs to stop those exposures for a number of days and then reintroduce to see on a causal relationship. This is similar but at a much larger level because the affected person is reacting to nearly everything in their everyday environment. So you reintroduce low-level exposures to investigate reactions, to look for polymorphisms, to understand this whole disease process. Next. Go on if I can turn my page. This is the research tool that Dr. Claudia Miller developed with funding from ATSDR, which is Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry at the CDC. The Quick Environmental Exposure Sensitivity Inventory, and it could be helpful for someone who's recently ill, who's trying to self-identify that they are indeed having this type of problem, and perhaps bring the survey to a physician trying to sort of elucidate what is going on. And the reason for this is the fact that we're in a situation where there is no one test for diagnosing, and there's extreme difficulty when patients do become sick in trying to determine what is going on and how do I address this. Next. The importance of healthy indoor air quality and environmental access barriers. I'm going to talk a moment about a study called the TEAM, T-E-A-M, standing for Total Exposure Assessment Methodology, or the TEAM study, done in the 80s, actually extended over into the 90s and published the original book in 1989, and it's a study that my guess everyone on this call knows the finding, even though you may not know that, and that is that common knowledge these days is that indoor environments are more toxic for select volatile organic compounds than outdoor air, sometimes 5 to 10 times, others 100 or 1,000 times more toxic. And post-World War II, we had a dramatic increase in production of organic chemicals and pesticides. So right now, 80,000 chemicals have been introduced into our environment since World War II, with hundreds to perhaps 1,000 new ones each year. And the big picture is that 80% plus of them have never been tested for their toxic or neurotoxic effects. Meanwhile, 90% of Americans spend 90% of their day indoors, whether it's home, school, office, or vehicle. So you have pretty significant issues going on with regard to exposure. And we're dealing with increased indoor air pollution sources, decreased fresh air intake because of energy savings efforts, and new or reformulated substances and products. And I think everybody on this call knows these days that you really can't depend on what you're going to find as far as consumer products on the shelf or building materials and what they're going to be made of from one day to the next. And let's go to the next. The basics of IEQ, or indoor environmental quality. So healthy indoor and outdoor environmental quality are critical to the health and well-being of everyone, but they're particularly critical for people impacted by environmental access barriers. Improving indoor environmental quality makes indoor environments healthier for everyone and more accessible for people with chemical and electrical sensitivities. And third, healthy and accessible environments at the most elemental level must be smoke, pesticide, and fragrance-free with minimal electromagnetic pollution. Next. The Indoor Environmental Quality IEQ Project Report published in 2006. It's a report that was funded by the U.S. Access Board, a little over 100 pages, a collaborative project conducted by the National Institute of Building Sciences, or NIBS, N-I-B-S, and we had four different advocates involved in the project itself. That would be Anna Campbell, Susan Malloy, Tony Temple, and myself. And we worked with indoor air experts, with building facilities folks, and others who were knowledgeable in these fields. The purpose was to make public and commercial buildings more accessible for people with chemical and electromagnetic sensitivities and healthier for everyone. It's a it was a very valuable step at the time. I think it promises much more, but much more needs to be done to sort of bring it to relevance right now. But anybody who's not looked at the report really should do so, because I think that they'll find it very useful. Next, federal recognition of chemical sensitivities. The Social Security Administration included these conditions in the Program Operations Manual in February 1988, an acknowledgement but no guarantee that you would be awarded Social Security. The Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice under the Americans with Disability Act guidelines issued in July 26, 1991 indicated that those severely affected by, use the term, multiple chemical sensitivity will satisfy the requirements to be considered disabled under the regulation, again, on a case-by-case basis. Department of Education has some decisions, and then the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, issued a legal memorandum in April 1992 that recognized multiple chemical sensitivity, or EI, environmental illness as quote-unquote handicaps under the Fair Housing Act, entitling reasonable accommodations on a case-by-case basis. Next. This is a brief history of the U.S. HUD recognition of chemical sensitivities. It was evolving from a policy issued in October of 1990, just a policy statement recognizing the disability and for reasonable accommodations for those disabled under the Fair Housing Act and the Rehab Act of 1973. The following year, they issued a draft technical guidance memorandum 91-3 that discussed HUD recognition of MCS as a handicap, provided examples of accommodations which are considered reasonable, so removal of carpeting and no pesticides. And then the HUD legal memorandum itself, which recognized MCSEI as physical disabilities, entitling reasonable accommodations on a case-by-case basis. It specifically excluded allergies, essentially said that if you're allergic to eggs, you know that and you can avoid it. Extended coverage to those recognized as disabled by the Social Security Administration, and listed up the federal agencies that recognize these conditions. There's a rather extensive history of policy development in the housing area. Conciliation decrees, Department of Justice consent decrees, settlements, Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. However, for most of us, these policies seem of little benefit. It's a constant challenge, and for many, a constant crisis. Without accessible housing and accessible health care, it's impossible to function in a work environment. I've worked in the last year or so off and on with a California woman who needed accommodations at work, but meanwhile, at the same time, she was homeless, so she had no stability in work, her health, or her life. I'm not covering these issues today, but there's more information on housing on a lengthier PowerPoint posted at the National ADA Network website, or folks can contact me for more information. Next, so we're on slide 16, some additional federal policies and healthier housing statements. So just a quick view, EPA has promoted integrated pest management going back to the mid-90s. The Food Quality Protection Act of 1996 restricted the use of the pesticide chlorpyrifos that actually came in 2000. It came as a result of realizing the impact of chlorpyrifos on brain development and IQ for fetuses and children, but huge numbers of people who are disabled by chemical exposures became that way as a result of exposure to chlorpyrifos or to Durispan. There's an IPM in multifamily housing maintenance training manual issued in 2009, issued multi-agency by Department of Agriculture, HUD, and CDC, that has slides in it that address these disabilities and avoiding pesticide use in public housing. And then there are two HUD public and Indian housing guidance documents, one that promotes integrated pest management, another for no smoking policies in public housing. Next. The EEOC has tracked chemical sensitivity charges, by charges they mean complaints, since 1993. For a decade or more, they actually tracked complaints with an actual breakdown of what types of complaints. At that time, it was interesting that chemical sensitivity charges for failure to accommodate were nearly double all other charges, and it had a lower rate of resolution than other charges. Chemical sensitivity charges have never been litigated. The agency is not aware of specific complaints regarding electrical sensitivities, although they did indicate perhaps it's been involved in larger complaints and not specifically identified. If you go to that link, you'll see the history of charges for all the various disabilities that they track. And for example, for the last concluding year, fiscal year 2013, there were 53 chemical sensitivity charges. There were 55 resolved, but not necessarily from that year, going from previous years. And 11 of those charges got monetary benefits around $300,000. The point being that it's good that we're being tracked, but we're a much lower number of charges than other areas, and certainly a much lower number of resolutions, but we are there. Next. Review some suggested workplace policies to eliminate or minimize access barriers. So no smoking policy indoors and at least 25, if not 50 feet from buildings, having a fragrance-free policy, having a policy that eliminates the use of synthetic pesticides, having cleaning maintenance policy that provides for least toxic, low-impact products and practices, a notification policy that pre-notifies for construction, roofing, and other activities like that, vehicle idling policy, and a cell phone, smartphone, Wi-Fi, and other EMF shielding policy, some of which might involve literally turning off things that are causing problems for employees, and others shielding being built into the structure itself. Some of these recommendations, a number of the recommendations come from the IEQ report itself and NIPS report that I referenced earlier. Next. Perfume pollutes. This is a button that our organization distributed many years ago now, but perfume pollutes is a very relevant topic for people who react to low-level chemical environmental exposures. Scent-scented products are significant indoor pollutants, and the nearly 3,000 chemicals in makeup fragrances are in all kinds of products, including pesticides. If you look at the International Fragrance Association's website, they have a list of those chemicals that are permitted in fragrance. And a single fragrance, for example, a number of years ago when I did an interview with the Detroit Free Press, they had indicated that Red from Giorgio, so perfume, I don't have a clue if it's still on the market, had 800 chemicals that made up that perfume. And people frequently wear, according to the statistics, 6 to 12 different scented products. So we're really talking about a sort of witch's brew, chemical soup type of a situation. And additionally, perfumes and fragrance products are not regulated. They're exempted from labeling requirements, and they don't need to disclose ingredients and formulations or confidential trade secret types of things. Some studies have found that 30% of Americans report irritation from scented products, 19% adverse health effects from air fresheners, another huge problem, huge exposure, and 10.9% reporting irritation from scented laundry products vented to the outdoors. Right now, there's actually recently a class action lawsuit filed in New Jersey alleging consumer fraud against Dwight & Church, that's Arm & Hammer, Procter & Gamble, Dial, Revlon, and Henkel for selling deodorants labeled unscented, but which indeed have fragrance chemicals that make up the product. Next. I'm going to actually review a number of different federal fragrance-free policies. The CDC issued an indoor environmental quality policy in June 2009. The fragrance-free policy says, quote, scented or fragranced products are prohibited at all times in all interior space owned, rented, or leased by the CDC. It goes on to say that fragrance is not appropriate for a professional work environment, and the use of some products with fragrance may be detrimental to the health of workers with chemical sensitivities, allergies, asthma, and chronic headaches or migraines. The CDC policy is the most comprehensive, and Daryl will talk more about the specifics during her presentation. Next. Additional federal fragrance-free policies with the Census Bureau, that's March 2009. It's a more limited policy. Health and Human Services adopted a policy in 2010 that restricted application of fragrance products. It restricted application of fragrance products at work, exempted its fitness centers and daycare centers. It had a list of non-permissible fragrance cleaning and maintenance products identical to the CDC fragrance-free policy. FEMA has blanket purchase agreements for medical supplies that require products to be latex and fragrance-free. Next. This is actually fragrance-free signage that is used at the Census Bureau. So in consideration of those who are sensitive to chemicals in fragrances, this area has been declared a fragrance-free zone. Please refrain from wearing perfumes and colognes in this area. Also, no air fresheners or fragrance-emitting devices, emitting plants, excuse me. Next. Some of the most extensive work in this area has been done by the U.S. Access Board, the Architectural and Transportation Bureau's Compliance Board. They've addressed fragrance-free policies. They've looked extensively at indoor environmental quality and specifically about at chemical and electrical sensitivities, but with much more work to be done there. In 1999, they held a training for the board and staff on fragrances and on indoor air quality. In 2000, they adopted a fragrance-free policy for board meetings, and that's the link to it, and that actually includes when they have a board meeting outside of their space, so in a hotel or something where they have specific protocol. 2000, they created a committee to examine chemical and electrical sensitivities, and then they contracted with NIBS, with the National Institute of Building Sciences, to study indoor environmental quality and chemical and electrical sensitivities. 2006, they issued the Indoor Environmental Quality Project Report, which was previously referenced, and then in 2010, they opened a permanent meeting space designated as fragrance-free. All participants must refrain from perfume and cologne, unscented personal care products, and scent-free cleaning and maintenance products. Announcements in the Federal Register, either issued by a government agency or another organization using this space, must reference the fragrance-free policy. Next. This signage is a large placard that's on an easel in the Access Board's meeting room space, which is Suite 800 at 1331 F Street in D.C. So the Access Board thanks all meeting participants in advance for refraining from wearing perfumes and other fragrances during all meeting events. And this is certainly an important step, and you need a fragrance-free or an accessible room and accessible restroom. Safer, better. On the other hand, not a guarantee. I've been in that space when people have pulled out Clorox wipes and wiped down tables or potpourri in the restroom or just the electronics. but better, getting better. Next slide, please. Okay, these are some observations on accommodating a chemically sensitive employee based on my communications with tens of thousands of individuals affected, trying to stay employed and affected by chemical sensitivities. Early on, chemical sensitivity may be a preventable disability. Avoidance of exposures triggering reactions is the key. Early intervention is critical to avert disability, but there's a very narrow time frame during which you can accommodate that person and minimize or halt the progression of the disease process. Many accommodations are modest and expensive and can be accomplished with common sense. The key point is that the affected individual is frequently the best judge of what needs to be done. Next. Suggestions for responding to environmental sensitivities in the workplace. For the employee, they might try to identify exposures triggering reactions. As appropriate, request product labels, material safety data sheets, and other pertinent information. Seek advice and support from advocates, indoor experts, union leaders, co-workers, and others. Develop an accommodation request, so perhaps remove air fresheners, generate a fragrance-free policy, change cleaning products, unplug some of the electrical appliances or devices. Then discuss that situation with their physician and request a letter of support, and then meet with their supervisor or employer to discuss the accommodation request. For the employer, it's important to listen to the employee's requests and try to work toward a solution, being aware that many modifications necessary to accommodate the environmentally sensitive employee make the workplace healthier for everyone, and that failure to accommodate may create or sanction an atmosphere of harassment, retaliation, and ostracize the disabled employee. Next. Basic accommodations might include a private office with a window that opens, a well-ventilated work environment free of pollutants such as tobacco smoke, pesticides, fragrances, and fragrance products, use of least toxic allergenic building materials, furnishings, and supplies, shielding from electromagnetic fields, or again, unplugging electrical items or turning off fluorescent lighting, things of that nature, pre-notification of building events, such as painting, remodeling, roofing, similar activities, with the provisions for alternative work arrangements, flexible work time and place, the option to work at home, and education, very key, education of coworkers to avert stigma and harassment. Next. I can turn my page. Hang on a second. All right. Here we go. Assistive technology for people with chemical and electrical sensitivities might include charcoal mask, industrial respirator, or other personal protection equipment or device, oxygen with ceramic or stainless steel mask and Tigon or stainless steel tubing, charcoal, HEPA, or other electronic air filter or other air filtering device or equipment, a reading box so that the affected individual is blocked from the fumes from printed page, low-emission computers, BDT terminals, and other equipment, restricting cell phones, smartphones, and Wi-Fi, hard-wiring phones and internet access, shielding from electromagnetic fields. Next. Localized exhaust for computers, printers, and other equipment, separating the person with chemical or electrical sensitivities from exposure to computers and electronic equipment, turning off fluorescent lighting with incandescent or natural lighting in lieu of fluorescent lighting, speakerphone or intercom system to participate in meetings and to communicate with others, and an assistant or errand runner who can take care of the tasks that the affected individual cannot perform due to chemical or electromagnetic exposures. Next. Incidents of overt harassment and discrimination. These are incidents that have been related to me through the years by disabled employees. So an employee forbidden to use a charcoal mask or oxygen at work, even in a private office, forbidden to open a window, again, in a private office, windows nailed shut to prevent opening, signs that request a specific accommodation and name the disabled employee, so please refrain from the use of perfumes for Bonnie. Next. Intentional or intensified use of perfume or other scented or problematic products, so nail polish, hairspray, in the workplace perfume poured on the chemically sensitive person's chair, air freshener sprayed on the employee's phone, use of cell phones, smartphones, or microwave ovens in the vicinity of the electrically sensitive employee, an employee accommodated, quote-unquote, by selecting the worst possible or least accessible work site. So a chemically sensitive employee moved into the janitorial storage office, a teacher with chemical sensitivities moved to a copy center, and another moved into the art room, and an electrically sensitive employee moved next to an electrical transformer. Next. This is a cleaner air signage. So this is a pictogram adopted by the California Building Standards Commission, the work of Susan Malloy, promoted by the Access Board in our IEQ report, in our Inter-Environmental Quality Project report. It indicates a space accessible for people with chemical and electrical sensitivities, similar to mobility signage. Next. So these are the parameters that would be designated by that cleaner air space. So a cleaner air room and path of travel, probably a restroom would be nice. No smoking, fragrance-free, pesticide-free, least toxic cleaning products, no recent construction or remodeling, cell phones and Wi-Fi turned off, the ability to turn off or unplug computers or other electrical equipment by occupant or staff, the ability to turn off fluorescent lighting, the ability to adjust temperature and airflow, or the availability of an operable window. This is recommended for perhaps independent living centers where either the building or at least a room and restroom that could be accessible for these populations. Hospital rooms would be nice to actually get health care and medical treatment. And the sign would be removed when the space and restroom are out of compliance. Next. I want to thank you for your time. I have over 30 years' experience in education, policy, development, advocacy in these areas. If you go to our website, you're not going to see this reflected, so I'm going to suggest that people who have questions for me or about our work or advocacy or anything else, call me, email me. If you need additional information, I would be glad to share. And now I'd like to go ahead and introduce Daryl Jones. Go ahead, Daryl. Daryl, are you with us?
I am so sorry, I had you on mute. I was trying to be responsible. Hi, everyone. I am so glad that you all could join us today. My voice is kind of challenged today, so if anything is not clear, feel free to ask for clarification when we get to the Q&A portion. Let's start with our next slide. After hearing everything that Mary has said, if you are feeling overwhelmed about accommodating people with sensitivities, you're not alone. If you think about what the person who deals with this on a personal basis is going through, it can help you, I think, to understand the world that the person walks in. But the really good news is that you don't have to do everything. You just need to start. And I particularly like this quote from Theodore Roosevelt when he said, do what you can with what you have where you are. Next. And when you think about all the aspects of managing your organization or your business, the approach that you would take with people who have sensitivities is going to be the same as trying to serve anyone else. You start with one policy at a time, one procedure at a time. And you hold this vision in your mind that you want to be inclusive. And as you put one foot in front of the other, you move closer and closer and closer to your goal. There are a few myths and realities that I think are worth discussing, because all of these things that have been mentioned up to this point kind of rest on some very foundational pieces. Let's go to the next slide. The first myth that regardless of how open and progressive some of us might think we are, there is this kind of idea running around that environmental and chemical sensitivities are psychological. Breaking down this myth is important because it creates a barrier for people in trying to get the medical care that they need, the emotional support that's really useful in helping them deal with the real challenges they're faced with, and getting the tangible accommodations they need. I would say that it's understandable that at one time it was assumed that it was psychological. This is a rather weird condition. I don't think anybody argues with that. This is an illness that came into being in the 20th century. We didn't have any history to really help with this. But today, there is so much literature on the topic that it's possible for everyone to become educated and to really understand the origins. And here's a link for you to go to if you want to spend some more time reading the science of this. This is from the website of the Chemical Sensitivity Foundation. Next. The second myth that I want to mention, because those who live with this condition hear this so often that it is kind of tiring, that it's the odor of something that people with chemical sensitivities react to. This is actually kind of a goofy myth. We hear that the person doesn't like the smell of my perfume, and they're just being contrary. Well, let's talk a little bit about the science of this here. It's actually the ingredients in chemicals that are toxic. It's not the smell of something. In order for you to smell something, molecules from that thing have to make it to your nose and then bind to the hair-like cilia and trigger the neuron that causes you to perceive a smell. A perfume, for example, could smell quite pleasant to the individual. But once the molecules of the chemicals in that perfume make it into the bloodstream of the person, they can still make the person very sick. And here's a link at the bottom that takes you to an explanation of the science of this. Next. The third myth that we need to dispel is that if a chemical has passed an inspection as being safe, it's not possible for daily low-level exposures to harm an individual. The thing is that this belief does not take into account that almost everyone on the planet today is exposed to far more than just one chemical on a daily basis. As Mary mentioned, there has been 80,000 chemicals introduced into our environment since World War II. There is no safety testing taking place that includes the cumulative impact of all of the chemicals that are in your environment at any point in time. Next. And the fourth myth is that sensitivity to chemicals is limited to very few people, and it's really almost non-existent. Well, I think Mary dispelled that myth with the statistics that she shared earlier. The percentage that we most often hear, and there are quite a few studies that are quite reliable done across the country, is that 16% of the population is unusually sensitive to chemicals. Up to 6% of the population is chronically ill, and disabled by exposures to chemicals, and about 3% report electrical sensitivities. I checked the U.S. Census Bureau's website last night to see what the current population of the United States is, and it's 319 million, just under. That means about 51 million people are unusually sensitive, and there are about 19 million of us who are chronically ill and disabled. Next. Let's take a look at some of the realities. And these are important because if you are a service provider, if you're an employer, if you're anyone who might come into the world of a person with the degree of sensitivity that is disabling, these are things that will be very helpful for you to understand. Many people with this condition, by the time they get to you, they feel pretty beat up. And that's because medicine has probably not been able to help them. Their friends and loved ones may not believe them, or they may not understand what they're going through. And they have these constant assaults on their well-being, their health, that is quite traumatic for many people. Their sense of self may really be compromised by the time they find their way to you. And they might be fearful about coming to yet another agency for services or applying for a job if they are able to work. Next. Many of us with these illnesses are used to someone saying, you don't look sick. Well, we understand that. But in fact, invisible chronic illness can be as debilitating as the physical disabilities that most people are more used to accommodating. And it can be really helpful to understand that. Next. The second reality is that many people with environmental sensitivities have lost everything, declared bankruptcy, gone through stretches of time in which they could not work or participate in anything. It may have taken them quite some time to figure out how to make their environment safe or how to ask for accommodations. The person who is newly disabled with these kind of conditions will be confused, will be afraid, and may be lost in a maze of different kinds of treatments and opinions for some time before they find their way to a place of stability. Your understanding of this can go a long way to helping the person feel validated. Next. And Mary talked a bit about the myriad of ways that body systems can be affected. And it's important for you to understand, as someone who is interested in making accommodations, because the range of effects on a single individual will be so limited to that individual. You've seen one person with this condition, you've seen one person with this condition. So you need to find out what the specifics are about this person. They may have physical things such as headache, severe fatigue, muscle pain, cognitive issues like memory loss, attention deficit issues, confusion. There could be neurological kinds of things like tics, nerve pain, and seizures, or psychological, irritability and depression. Next. As you think about how you might accommodate a specific individual, the more you understand about that person's needs, the more you will be able to figure out exactly what's going to be supported. For example, if a person has cognitive difficulties, they might need similar kinds of accommodations to someone who has a head injury or attention deficit or learning disabilities. The key is to know the individual. Next, the fourth reality is that if you are a nonprofit organization, a small business, or a government entity, you may not have the budget to take on all the issues related to environmental sensitivities. Not only can taking on all of them be overwhelming, it can be costly, but you can take on something and you can make a difference. You can make a huge difference for some people because many things are low cost or no cost. Next. I have 15 things in mind that I would like to suggest that you think about. And the first is just kind of a personal kind of thing that you could do, and that's to take the person at the work. If they tell you they react to the plastic in their telephone or to the electromagnetic fields from their computer, accept that at face value. If you get caught up in judgments about things being imaginary or psychological, you can't be really helpful to that person. The second is to focus on functional issues and to help that person to focus on functional issues. You can use a structured interview with a checklist that helps to keep you focused. Stay focused on the mechanics of the accommodations that are needed. Next. Here's an example of some items on a checklist. What specific limitations is the person experiencing? And how do those limitations affect the person's daily activities? What specific activities are problematic? And what accommodations would assist in reducing or eliminating these problems? Which ones are not negotiable? You know, which ones are deal breakers? And which ones could be phased in over time as resources allow? Next. The third thing you can do, as Mary mentioned in some of the policies that she talked about, is to enact a fragrance-free policy. And don't get caught up in debates about individual rights to put whatever you want to on your body. If you're in the business of serving people, you need to be as accessible as you can be. And then advertise your policy liberally so that people know about it. You will attract consumers and customers if they know that you are paying attention to their issues. Next. Here is an example of an announcement that I especially like that comes from the Arizona Bridge to Independent Living in Phoenix. They put this on materials of all kinds, brochures and flyers, and I've seen it as taglines on some of their emails. To accommodate those with allergies, breathing conditions, or multiple chemical sensitivities, please do not smoke or wear scented products when attending ABLE events or visiting ABLE offices. ABLE's events are accessible and in compliance with ADA guidelines. Upon request, we provide sign language interpreters and materials in alternate formats. The reason I like this one so much is that they integrated the environmental accommodations with other types of accommodations that people are generally more familiar with. It gives legitimacy to environmental accommodations. Next. Mary also mentioned this policy, fragrance-free policy, from the CDC. I'm not going to read it to you again, but I wanted to draw your attention to the fact that this policy is a part of a 13-page indoor environmental quality policy that they passed in 2009 that's available at the link there at the bottom of your slide. Next, some of the other products that are not permissible to use at the CDC are things like incense, candles, fragrance-emitting devices of any kind, potpourri, and so forth. Next. And this is a copy of signage that the CDC uses. In the same vein that they tell people to remember proper hand washing, and we see those signs just about everywhere, they include a statement, the scented products release chemicals that may trigger serious health reactions in people with asthma, migraines, and allergies. I think the CDC's total policy is an excellent one that you might use as a template to develop a policy for your own organization. Next. The fourth thing you can do is include in your policy that the least toxic cleaning products will be used in your office and that potpourri, air fresheners, and those other kinds of scented products will not be used. Be conservative about renovations. Nobody's telling you don't do renovations, but use the least toxic paint and building products. These are now readily available. You just need to ask for them. Provide advance notice of chemical usage, such as carpet shampooing, floor waxing, or painting through email or signage. Send out an email to your distribution list or put signs outside your entrance doors that such activities are taking place. Then individuals get to choose whether to enter or come back later. Next, use only integrated pest management practices that will be safe for all your staff, visitors, and customers. At the end of the presentation, I have a resource page that has a link where you can get more information about integrated pest management. When possible, have cleaning done when the building is not occupied to reduce exposure. If your space and resources allow, create a safe room where individuals with environmental sensitivities are using individuals with environmental sensitivities to advise you on the design and construction of the room. And this last one on this slide isn't always possible, but if you can provide an office or workspace that has a working window, it seems like such a simple thing, but it can have a huge impact. Next. If consumers or customers are too ill to come to your office, find ways of providing services that are safe over the phone through email. Lots of people are into Skype these days. If your organization provides housing location assistance, when you survey landlords, include questions about environmental factors, such as any renovations that the landlord intends or how he or she use pesticides, any neighborhood features such as industrial emissions. Every community has different factors. Next. Here's a quick note about integrated housing, because housing is such a huge issue for all people with disabilities, particularly if accessible features and affordability are factors. Not every person who has a disability is in search of integrated housing. People with environmental sensitivities sometimes need segregated housing. So if someone asks you for help in locating that, don't take it as a personal affront to your disability rights philosophy. Every person is an individual, and it's so key to keep that in mind. Next slide. Provide the option of an employee with sensitivities working at home if a job can be done at a distance. And if that's not feasible, work with them to create a safe zone within the office that will make their continued employment manageable. Recognize that some people may need to rest during the course of a day. So if you can provide a cot or other place where they can lie down, that can help tremendously. Next, here is an example of an accommodation from the Job Accommodation Network that many of you are probably familiar with. There was a clerical employee having difficulty breathing due to coworker fragrances and new carpet fumes. The coworkers were asked to eliminate the use of fragrances, and the time the employee spent in the office was reduced by allowing her to communicate with coworkers by telephone, email, and fax. They also suggested that the carpet be detoxified or removed and replaced with tile or wood. Next. The last thing that I put on my list, again, is another very personal thing that I think each person who is interested in being supportive and accommodating can do, and that's to really educate yourself about the key issues so that you can provide the kind of support and advocacy that the person really wants and needs. The three top issues you will likely encounter, and this is just from my own experience, is the first is that the individual has constant challenges to their identity, because typically what happens is that the person's world continues to shrink as more and more sensitivities are added to what they're experiencing. For you to understand this, to be compassionate, non-judgmental, can be life-saving. Safe housing is the second issue that you are likely to hear most about. It's extremely hard to come by. So everything that you can do in your community to promote non-toxic approaches to construction, to lessening industrial emissions, to providing a market of apartments and other kinds of housing that people can actually choose from, could help tremendously with this population. Next. The third thing that you can do is brainstorm solutions with the person if they want you to do that, because often a person is severely fatigued or they might be dealing with cognitive problems. So your assistance in sorting through the resources and accommodations could be very welcome to that person. Next. And here's that list that I mentioned of resources that I particularly like, including the Job Accommodation Network that many of you are probably familiar with already, several that are related to chemical sensitivities, and then the material on integrated pest management. The final slide is my contact information, and feel free to contact me if you have any follow-up questions. Thank you. Marissa?
Okay, well, thank you so much, Daryl and Mary.
At this time, I just want to remind folks that you can type your questions there into that chat area. I do have a couple. However, I want to ask the operator if there are any questions on the line at this time.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press the stars and the one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Okay. We'll go ahead and start with a couple of questions that we've gotten here. First question is, I think this can be either of you. Do you have more information? Oh, okay. I think this is directed towards Mary. You previously mentioned a class action lawsuit. Do you have more information that you could give us? Where could we find information regarding that lawsuit that you mentioned?
Yes. I actually did have it attached, and then I removed it from my talk. So I'm going to look as I'm speaking here. But if not, anyone who's interested can email me. I actually have a copy of the lawsuit, and I could certainly send the citation. I'm just not sure I can quickly find it as we're talking. But just give me 1 minute just to see. And again, I have lots of papers here, and I did have it, but I'm not sure I'll come up with it. So I'm going to leave that maybe as a suggestion right now, and if I do find it as we're talking. But it was filed in by an attorney in Philadelphia. It's filed in New Jersey. Okay, hold on. The attorney is Mark L. Rhodes, R-H-O-A-D-E-S, and again, filed in New Jersey. And now I'm looking for the title of the I don't have that right off.
Okay.
So anyone who's interested could actually email me, and I would send that.
Okay, we'll post Mary's email address in that chat area too, and it's also on the slides. Our next question is, in your experience, have you seen many correlations between our use / dependence on oil and gas products and how this affects people?
This is Mary, and I think the primary factor there is that petrochemicals as a whole group are a primary class of things that people who develop sensitivities react to. So it's a huge issue, but that does not mean, on the other hand, for people who become extremely disabled, and you might use the term environmental illness, they just react to just all types of things. Many people will start reacting to natural substances as well as petrochemicals. But yeah, it's a sort of almost like it's a primary factor in this whole area.
Okay, Daryl, do you have anything to add?
Nope, I think she summed it up.
Okay. Do you have any? Our next question is: do you have any suggestions, short or of a full-fledged fragrance-free policy, for effectively influencing the behavior of coworkers who do insist on their right to wear fragrances? Does raising awareness accomplish anything?
This is Mary, and I'm going to say that when the Access Board, what was shared with me and my recollection of it, back in 1999, when they had their first training for their board and staff on indoor air quality and fragrances, it was related back to me that many people, again, they're an agency dealing with people who are disabled, related the stigmas that we hear, that, you know, they didn't believe people could be sick from fragrances. They just thought it was, you know, all psychological or sort of a put on. And so those stigmas and thoughts are out there. And I think their education is a really key piece. You know, hearing from people who are affected, hearing the scientific data, as Daryl was relating, I think those are all important pieces, and that helps, plus the supportive management. If supervisors, if those people in charge forward an approach that says that, you know, these are reasonable requests, we have to move in this direction, I think that plays a big role in the acceptance of other employees.
I agree. Education is key. And just as you would educate your staff about a wide range of people that you serve, this could be a part of an overall program. It doesn't have to be singled out and make it stigmatized.
Okay. Thank you, ladies. At this time, I'll ask the operator again if there are any questions on the line.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, again, if you do have any questions at this time, please press the star and the one key on your touchtone telephone.
Okay. I think we'll move on to our next question. Barry, you previously mentioned something known as a charcoal mask in one of your slides. Could you explain a little bit more about what that is and how someone might obtain one?
Yes, there are numbers of different types of masks that someone might use, depending on what types of substances they react to. And so that I've seen everything from cotton within cotton as a mask that you would put at your face or have some type of a ties in the back to attach it, and others made of silk with silk, and then some with charcoal, and there are actually different types of activated charcoal, and the charcoal is activated so that it filters out chemicals. And I think I'd probably need an email to send a response with sources right now, but they are a product that is out there in the community for people who might need them. So.
Okay, thank you. Okay, question for the panel. As workplaces start to go much more mobile with a move to smaller workplaces, for example, hot desks, bring your own device to work, and a push for mobile phones and tablets as work devices, what can be done in these environments to best accommodate employees who have an electrical sensitivity?
Well, this is Daryl. I am not an expert on electrical sensitivities, and the new mobile devices are creating some new levels of issues. Historically, with regular kinds of computers, there were shielding boxes that could be used that computers could be put inside of. And a person's hands would go through a slot to work the keyboard. I am not aware of what's being done around mobile phones and tablets and that sort of thing. Mary, have you heard of what's happening in that arena?
Well, I think in one respect it's going to further not just it's going to further isolate a significant population who are extremely debilitated by very low-level exposures to electromagnetic fields. And so I think you're going to have that factor, and you're going to have, I think, more people beginning to react. Actually, I had a meeting with several folks. It was folks at FEMA who expressed to me that when they're sort of out in the hinterlands, because many of them get sent on to different places that are remote as part of their agency responsibilities, and they expressed to me the fact that when they return, they have a sense of, like, it's almost like your hair standing on edge type of a feeling, but they became much more aware of all the sort of what they assumed was electromagnetic sensations around them. So I think that it's going to, create more problems with workplaces than we already have. And, you'll see information on, like, that you need to hardwire, that you need to put up, foil-backed walls to sort of try to lessen electromagnetic fields. But with these open space plans and so forth and so much electronics, I'm not sure how you're going to curtail that sufficiently, even for people who are moderately affected.
I think if people at least have access to headphones so that they're not holding devices up next to their heads or actually having to have it next to their bodies, this may help some people.
Okay. Next question is, I think we have time for a couple more. I find many fragrance policies do not specifically call out laundry fragrances. They seem to be the 900-pound gorilla in the room nobody wants to acknowledge. And if this is not addressed, accommodation fails for many. Are there any strategies that you can think of, you know, what work strategies can you think of to get laundry very specifically, called out in a fragrance policy?
Well, you do see, you know, some meeting policies. Sometimes it has to do with people who are meeting who are sensitive to chemicals, you know, specifically calling that out. But I think that they are presumed to be included, like the CDC policy when it says, you know, the no scented personal care products. I think that that's presumed to be part of that. But I think there's another factor there. You know, with this, the lawsuit that I had mentioned, and you know, the fact that you have companies purporting to have fragrance-free products on the market, but those products indeed having fragrance, I think is another confounding factor in this whole area. But, you know, I don't see anything wrong, though, where, you know, maybe we do need to start a trend where we are specifically calling that out. But I do think when it says, you know, no perfumes, no fragrances, and no scented personal care products, that that's sort of presumed to be a part of that. You know, but there is a, you know, that whole trend of, you know, products where put this in your washer and your scent is going to last 30 days. I mean, it's really getting sort of a hyperbole effect in that whole area of scented laundry, and the person's right that difficult to deal with.
It is difficult to deal with. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that education is such a fundamental part of what has to take place, because this is a strange situation. This is a strange illness. And when you start talking to people about their personal rights to put on their body what they want, it creates an atmosphere of hurt feelings and hostilities, and all kinds of emotional factors start coming up when you move into that kind of territory. So it needs to be approached, I believe, as factually based and as personally as can be done when you're trying to kind of mediate between coworkers and other people who come into close contact.
Okay, thank you, ladies. Next question is, unscented versus fragrance-free. Are these two different things? Can you clarify?
This is Mary. And my understanding has always been that fragrance-free meant that there were no scent chemicals, so those nearly 3,000 chemicals that make up fragrances, in the product, whereas unscented might have masking agents or other things sort of overriding those fragrance chemicals. So that, for example, if you're buying a Magic Botanicals that makes a line of shampoos and lotions and so forth, and they clearly say fragrance-free, and if you look at their bottle, there are no chemicals listed on there that are fragrance. There's no fragrance listed, you know, as a matter of the ingredient list. So.
Okay, thank you. All right, I think we have time.
Oh, I have the lawsuit finally.
Oh, you do, great.
Yeah, if you give me 1 second here. Okay, so Melissa Fogarty, F-O-G-A-R-T-Y, versus Church & Dwight, case number 3:14, and I just lost it. Well, that's the site. Hang on. Maybe I can get it back here again. Or maybe not. Anyway, that's the...
Is it Fogarty versus Dwight?
Church & Dwight. That's people who make Arm & Hammer.
Okay.
Church & Dwight.
Church & Dwight.
And without another minute or two, I now can't get back to the whole citation.
That's okay.
That's the primary parties.
Okay. What we can also do, Mary, is if you wouldn't mind emailing me that, mm-hmm. and we can send that info along and have it posted with the archive file.
Okay, that sounds.
I think we are just about out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and close it up, do our closing here, but I want to let you know, I know there's some questions we did not get to. Both of our presenters have provided their information here today, so if you would like to email them your questions, you know, if there's someone in particular that we didn't get to your question, I do apologize. I know we had a bunch of them. You can also call the center that serves you at 1-800-949-4232 if you do have questions as well. But again, I want to just thank Mary Lamille and Daryl Jones, again, for your wonderful presentation and your information today. This concludes today's ADA audio conference program. Again, we realize many of you still have questions for them and apologize if we didn't get a chance to get to your question. Certainly, we've got our presenters' contact information there so you can get in touch with them. Once again, thank you, ladies, for your presentation and for sharing your time and your knowledge with us today. I think we certainly learned a great deal from the program. A quick reminder that the digital recording of today's session, as well as a written transcript, will be available for viewing and download at the www.ada-audio.org website within about 10 business days. Please join us again for next month's session. That's going to be Accessible Construction Management with Andrea Heinlein-Mott. I hope I pronounced that correctly. For more information on that session or to register, again, you can visit www.ada-audio.org. Again, for questions regarding the ADA Audio Conference Series, you can direct those to by calling 877-232-1990 or via email to info@ada-greatlakes.org. Again, thank you to our presenters and the staff at the Great Lakes for today. Thanks for joining us, everyone, our audience, and have a good day. At the conclusion of this session, you will receive an email with a link to the online session survey. Please complete the evaluation for today's program, as we certainly value your input. Thank you again, everyone. You may now close out your session.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes.